Sebastian Hart, Faded Gold, The Fell Omen. Sorry, I set those in a weird order. That is the song Fell Omen from the album Faded Gold, which I got to help release through Spirit Moves Records and turned a year old the other day. So happy birthday to them. You are listening to Syrup Moose Radio on here housed at 93.9 FM CICK, but you could be listening to this in any number of places, which is very cool to me. I hope wherever you're listening from, you're having a good time. All right, folks, we are going to very quickly set this documentary up. It is called No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism. It reviews all great events of social history for the last two centuries and reveals the origin and destiny in this political current has been fighting for over 150 years. It is, so it's split into three parts or books, and it is from France, Sweden, and Switzerland. A lot of the experts in the documentary are French. Don't worry, there is... it is dubbed over in English for folks to hear and understand. I think it will work pretty well as a audio documentary. I again recommend seeking it out on your own because I do think it is excellent and should be watched. It is available on DVD through Icarus Films. It's also in its entirety on YouTube and, Internet Archive. It's all over the place. It's relatively easy to find, and you can get it from your library. Directed by Tancred Ramonet, written by the same person. At least that's the only written, the only credited writers and directors on it. Also produced by Sarah Brucker, Martin Laurent, and Tancred Ramonet. So, yeah, it's going to be three parts. First part we're going to hear now, and the other parts will be next week and the week after. I will come back briefly at the end to say goodbye and maybe play you out with something, but enjoy it. This is No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism. This is episode one, titled... Oh, yeah, I should give you the title and the context, because that's actually really useful. Bear with me here, folks. It is, okay, so the first episode is called Urge for Destruction, and it covers the period from 1840 to 1906. The series only gets up to 1945, but do not let that make you believe that anarchism ended in 1945, because it very much did not. Anyway, enjoy it, and we'll be back.
Who are they? Where did they come from? And what are the thoughts of self-proclaimed anarchists, past and present? And why, even though they're on file, are their faces a mystery to us? Why does their thinking seem so confused and their history so troubling? A child of capitalism, a brother enemy of state communism, anarchism is a wind of revolt that has continued to blow all around the world. And while certain libertarians turn criminal, wielding firearms or setting off dynamite, it's worth remembering that many of them offered alternatives and triggered revolutions across the five continents. The establishment has always come down hard on them, wherever they may be, dragging them in chains to the guillotine or strapping them to electric chairs. But punishments aside, any attempts to dismiss the actions of anarchists as mere hooliganism or to wipe the memories of their victories from the social consciousness have failed. While their practices have become part of the fabric of life, as their ideas eventually became popular, spreading and forming networks, seducing the younger generation from Paris to New York, from Tokyo to Buenos Aires, anarchists continue to fuel fantasy and sow misunderstanding. Whence then the smell of sulfur that precedes each of these somber processions? And what wild hopes are raised with every black flag? How can anarchism, which dreamed of an alternative future for the old world and has been fighting masters and gods for 150 years, still ask questions that are relevant to us today? And why is its history swinging like a pendulum, lurching from left to right, from insurrection to attempted murder, more than ever a reflection of our own? It all began in France in the 19th century. The country, like the rest of the world, was in the throes of the new economic system called capitalism, making its first tentative steps around the globe. The capitalist ethos was spreading as the landscape became pockmarked by heavy industry. But the mirages formed in the midst of the first industrial revolution soon dissipated to reveal a darker, more brutal reality. Attempts to answer the questions being asked by a new era steeped in contradictions soon materialized in the form of anarchism.
What was the big problem with the 19th century? In simple terms, it was what was known as the social issue. Society was developing, rail travel, steam-powered locomotives, ships and looms were being invented. On one level, society was making considerable progress in terms of hygiene, medicine, and all that goes with it. And yet the appalling misery of those working in the manufacturing industry and what would become known as factories had never been so pronounced. All the great thinkers, Saint-Simon, Fourier, Proudhon, Marx, Cabet, Owen, and the rest, were striving to solve this contradiction.
To understand the emergence of anarchism during this period, it's important to grasp the troubled and miserable existence of the proletariat, who had nothing but their muscle. Their working day lasted 12 hours or more, and the wage they drew for their efforts was not enough to stave off hunger. They had no day of rest, no insurance, no pension. Their children were put to work as soon as they could stand, and half of them died before the age of six. Deficiencies, epidemics, and alcohol wreaked havoc. Illiteracy was the norm, and accidents were rife. In 1840, the life expectancy of a worker was barely 30 years. And yet, just as the middle classes, enjoying the opulent lifestyle that came with progress, were able to forge their ideology in liberalism, the proletariat began to see a possible answer to the problems of the period in the socialism that was taking shape. But before it could provide a real solution to injustice, socialism had to first overcome another almost philosophical contradiction.
From classical liberalism, the overriding problem in political philosophy was the reconciling of freedom with equality. How to ensure the widest possible range of freedoms with the greatest possible degree of equality, inasmuch as without equality, freedom remains incomplete. The ideals of freedom and equality needed to be reconciled. As an American anarchist said, freedom without equality is the jungle. Equality without freedom is prison, and we want neither the jungle nor prison. This conundrum, the attempt to reconcile maximum freedom with maximum equality, this dual aspiration for both equality and freedom, is one of the fundamental values of anarchism.
Until midway through the 19th century, the term anarchism, from the Greek anarche, meaning absence of power, was a negative term used to designate disorder and chaos. But while major figures like Sade, Babeuf, or Godwin had been dubbed anarchists, it was Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, one of the few thinkers with a working-class background, who used it to define a revolutionary political stance, and in doing so, invested the term with a positive value. In 1840, Proudhon wrote the memoir for which he is famous, What is Property? While the answer he offered to the question, property is theft, immediately caused a scandal, it was in the Declaration of Faith, a few lines later, that the true birth of anarchist thought could be found. It is a paradox that says it all.
Well, you're a Democrat? No. What? You would have a monarchy? God forbid. Then you're an aristocrat? Not at all. You want a mixed government? Still less. Then what are you? I am an anarchist. Although a firm friend of order, I am, in the full force of the term, an anarchist.
At the same time, while claiming to be an anarchist, he declared that property is theft, meaning that he deems property to be the basis of a certain social order, and to declare oneself an anarchist is to say, I am attacking the very foundations of the social order, identified as being property.
Proudhon went even further, because according to him, there are close links between the political domination exercised by the state, the economic domination exercised by capital, and the religious domination exercised by the idea of God. So Proudhon truly is the father of anarchy, as he was the only one to connect these three forms of domination. He believed that they had to be destroyed simultaneously if the social structure was to be changed.
While Proudhon advocated the destruction of power in order to change the social structure, he denounced revolutionary violence. His vision was for a mutual system underpinned by his People's Bank. His thinking, though, came under attack from all sides. He was criticized, lampooned, and outlawed. But his writings traveled, and his anarchism appealed to socialists all over the world, such as a young doctor in philosophy named Karl Marx, who proclaimed them to be the harbinger of the new European workers' movement. And even further afield, on the outskirts of Europe, in distant Russia, Count Lev Nikolaevich Tolstoy borrowed the title of a Proudhon essay for his new book, War and Peace. But it was with Mikhail Bakunin, a former cadet who went through every prison in Europe and was several times sentenced to death, that anarchism would become revolutionary thinking in the strictest sense.
While Proudhon was the first to use the term anarchist, Bakunin was arguably a more important figure in the final wording of the manifesto, adding as he did the principle of revolution to Proudhon's ideas.
He differed from Proudhon in advocating insurrection. He thought that the only way to abolish capitalism in the state was through an armed revolution.
Bakunin began to spread anarchist ideas within the New International Association of Workers, better known as the First International. This association, set up in 1864 in London, established that the emancipation of the workers must be the work of the workers themselves, and gathered at its launch more than 2,000 workers, sweepers, laborers, guilders, carpenters, and joiners from all over the world. It was, in the eyes of the Russian revolutionaries, an ideal instrument for honing the anarchist project and presenting it to the world.
At every conference, they discussed the means of production. Should it be collectivized? Is everyone entitled to their own means of production? Should it be shared? Were cooperatives and collectivities needed? What should be done about inheritance and money? What was the role of women, and so forth? A whole range of problems that until then had never been addressed.
But after the death of Proudhon, between Bakunin, the heir apparent to the mantle, father of anarchism, and Marx, who had long since split with the author of The Philosophy of Poverty, the debate went downhill. Their quarrel, as much personal as it was political, soon divided the socialist movement. Three major movements emerged: a somewhat minority reformist movement that dismissed the virtues of revolution, a Marxist movement qualified by the anarchists as authoritarian, which believed that an order would be established through the dictatorship of the proletariat, and finally, Bakunin's anti-authoritarian or anarchist movement, which advocated insurrection and final destruction of all state apparatus.
For both anarchists and Marxists, communism was a stateless society, but while Marxists thought they could use the state apparatus of oppression to construct a new society, the anarchists believed that communism would come once the state was abolished in the social revolution.
Marx thought you had to have a central political party with a command structure that could mobilize people in order to take power, and then using that power create socialism.
Bakunin
Given the anarchist ideals he adhered to, given his mistrust of power and authority, Bakunin was convinced that such thinking was a colossal error. The thrust of his discourse was, taking a leading revolutionary, put him on the throne of all Russia, and within a few years you'll have a despot. He predicted that in Russia, if the revolution took the form advocated by Marx, a terrible red bureaucracy would emerge.
Standing almost 2 meters tall and with his clear blue eyes, Bakunin, who spoke five languages, soon won over influential members of the International, such as the Swiss James Guillaume, the French Élie-Élisée Reclus, the Spaniard Anselmo Lorenzo, the Italian Malatesta, and a little later the Russian Prince Kropotkin. Thanks to them, anarchism became an international movement and the most popular revolutionary ideology among the various socialist currents.
I think it's fair to say that if you counted globally the amount of Marxist members, you could probably scrape together about 1,000 members, whereas the anarchist wing, as it later on became known, you had much larger formations of 60,000 in Spain, of 15,000 in Mexico, etc. Much more significant formations.
With followers of Bakunin and Proudhon now in the majority within the International, many of their disciples could be found in France too. When the Paris Commune broke out in 1871, the anarchists were in the forefront. And along with the other revolutionaries, they threw themselves wholeheartedly into the insurrection.
It was the great hope, the dream, a whole city suddenly becoming autonomous, ridding itself of its masters, of the old world, and reinventing everything.
For 73 days, Paris rose up, shot a few generals, burned land registers, toppled the old idols, and returned power to the people. On the ruins of the old order, the revolutionaries within the International set aside divisions and together tried to build a better world. Everyone was supplied according to their needs. The poor were fed, the illiterate taught to read and write, and the disabled cared for. Church and state were separated, the arts became accessible to all. Women were given an education, the vote, and control over their bodies. And the city worked almost without any government.
In the real sense, the Commune was not an anarchist event. It was a first attempt at destroying the state immediately and entirely. There was the idea of a sudden uprising and the capture of a capital's economic and political life by the population itself.
The Paris Commune may not have been anarchist, but those who proclaimed themselves to be anarchists, or those who soon would, such as Louis Michel, were in the front line. And when the movement spread to French cities such as Lyon, Bakunin himself took part in the insurrection. Within a few days, the state had been abolished. He believed the Grand Soir had finally arrived. But the government was already striking back. The Communards raised the barricades and prepared for battle. In the course of a long week, in Haussmann's Paris, a civil war broke out in which workers, men, women, and children were pitched against a trained army. The ensuing counter-revolutionary backlash reflected the fear that the Commune had struck into the hearts of the bourgeoisie. The troops fired indiscriminately. The pride of the proletariat was cut down as Paris became a mass grave.
It was a massacre that's difficult to imagine today. The number of dead has long been disputed. 25,000, 30,000, probably closer to 20,000. Killing 20,000 people within a week, using the firearms of the day, would have been practically impossible. The killing ceased on May 28, 1871, because the earth, the gutters, and the sewers of Paris were overflowing with blood.
The brutality of the suppression of the Paris Commune shocked many people on the left in Europe, and many Europeans in general, actually. This was seen as, interpreted by some anarchists as a sign that if the ruling class is going to behave like this, that we can behave how we like too. We can respond in the same kind of terms.
They said this proves that you cannot have peaceful change, because if you try any other way, you're just going to get massacred like the Communards were. And if you try to do things peacefully, they would shoot you down.
Many anarchists died in the bloodshed, while many others were banished to the Caledonian penal colonies. The few to avoid death or the wrath of the state were condemned to exile and misery. With their numbers diminished, the Marxists seized the movement to expel anarchists from the International. but anarchism survived. Bakunin managed to flee in disguise. He gathered his last forces in his Saint-Imier stronghold in Switzerland in the Jura Mountains, sealing an alliance that would herald the official birth of his movement.
At that time, there were around 15 of them, 12 young people aged between 20 and 30, who had come from Spain, Italy, and Switzerland. The others were a little older, Bakunin, along with a Spaniard, and Gustave Lefrançais, a communard.
They set up a new organization. Historians do not include them in the ranks of the International. This was a new organization. At least the name he gave it couldn't have been more unambiguous, the Anti-Authoritarian International.
The National Workingmen's Association adopted a range of measures, foremost of which was a duty to destroy all political power. So for the first time, an organization with stated anarchist objectives came into existence.
In Saint-Imier, by signing an alliance of friendship, solidarity, and mutual defense, the anarchists seized their independence. They drew up a charter, an organization, and a program. Organizational horizontality, anti-authoritarianism, revolutionary radicalism, internationalism, atheism, free speech, free thought, equality for all, and rejection of party politics. Every aspect of libertarian thinking was collected here for the first time. The anarchists even invented a new weapon, the widespread use of which would have the capacity to destroy any political power and launch a revolution.
The main instrument of the revolution was the general strike. This was a new term coined in Saint-Imier. Trade unionism did not yet exist, much less the concept of anarcho-syndicalism. But everything was ready and in place. The aim wasn't to exist or carry on, it was to start a revolution.
It was in the nascent United States of America that large-scale use of this new weapon would be seen for the first time. Introduced in the great waves of migrations, anarchism took root here too. Among the battalions of poor people who came to swell the industrial centers of the North, where wage earners resembled nothing so much as Southern slaves, conditions were conducive to its development. In no small part because in the early 1880s, the Civil War dragged on in social struggles such as Pennsylvania's Great Railroad Strike, which the federal government countered by sending in the army. Bayonet charges claimed dozens of workers' lives. For newcomers, the American dream often turned into one long nightmare.
The common story of immigrant anarchists, be they German or Jewish or Italian, they are either skilled workers who can only find unskilled employment, or unskilled workers who can only find the most demeaning of work. So they become disillusioned with the economic opportunities available to them. They become disillusioned with the political system, which they know vaguely is supposed to be democratic and republican, but which they find in this time period is dominated by corruption, by corporate power. And some of these disillusioned immigrants then encounter radical ideas.
This encounter with radical ideas occurred notably in Chicago, a city that immigrants flooded into. Steel, concrete, and the meat industry needed manpower. Plagued with a rising mafia in the pay of the all-powerful industrialists, the city was overflowing with segregated workers, prostitutes, and street children. It was fast becoming the home of protest.
Chicago was the center of anarchist activity in the United States in the 1880s.
It was a city in which labor relations were pretty harsh. There was basically no room for negotiation, no room for compromise. So there really was a situation, the stark situation in which you had the workers often living in unbelievably harsh conditions, and a local ruling class, a local business elite, that was not prepared to make any concessions whatsoever towards them.
Inspired by the new anarchist strategy, in 1886, on May 1st, then just a day like any other, a general strike was called. 340,000 workers gathered to demand an 8-hour day. The police broke up the demonstration forcefully. Walls became covered with calls for revenge. 2 days later, the anarchists organized a protest in Haymarket Square. The event was to become a key moment in the history of the workers' movement.
Few of the leading anarchists of the city spoke against what had happened. And during that demonstration, the police arrived in force. And at some point in that night, the police moved in to try and clear the demonstration.
Somebody threw a homemade bomb at the police. It exploded, killing and injuring several officers who then opened fire on the crowd.
A few people were killed. There was a shootout. Police pulled out their guns and started shooting at people. And some of the people in the crowd, including, I'm sure, some anarchists, had come armed. And to this day, of course, Americans like to carry weapons around with them. The authorities decided that the anarchists were to blame, even though they didn't have any hard evidence.
The Chicago police rounded up dozens of anarchists and arrested anarchists who they blamed for the event, blamed for the bombing, one of whom had never been there, two of whom had never even been at the demonstration that night. So this was seen as, this, in some ways, was the classic example of reactionary forces within a particular city, Chicago in this case, using an event like this to justify an exemplary act of repression.
8 anarchists were accused of throwing the bomb. In his plea, the prosecutor hinted at their innocence.
We know that these 8 men are no guiltier than the thousands who follow them, but they've been singled out because they are leaders. Gentlemen of the jury, make an example of them. Hang them, and you will be saving our institutions and our society.
Of the 8, 5 were sentenced to death. Louis Ling committed suicide in prison. The other 4, August Spies, George Engel, Adolf Fischer, and Albert Parsons, were hanged.
It was only in 1893 that the governor of Illinois actually pardoned all the anarchists who had been hanged, and he actually blamed the police for it. He particularly blamed the police chief of Chicago, saying that he had organized the whole thing and that he may well have even been responsible for perpetrating this bombing.
This generated enormous outrage, not only among anarchists, but even liberal-minded people, because the trial had been so unfair. As a result of the Haymarket martyrs being executed, they became folk heroes, not only among the anarchists, but among socialists all over the world. And so you would see their portraits in trade union offices in England and France and Latin America.
As a result of the global impact of the Haymarket affair, May the 1st was adopted as International Workers' Day. In the years that followed, demonstrations led by anarchists were held everywhere. But it was notably in France that the Chicago massacre heralded a new era of anarchism, one characterized by bombs and propaganda by the deed.
Propaganda by the deed, with no specific perpetrator, is a spontaneous expression of revolutionary action. It doesn't have to be an explosion or a bomb, just an action that goes beyond words. The anarchists believe that heroic action was the best way to get the libertarian message across.